Welcome back to the Bob Davis Podcasts. This is going to be podcast 576. It is Saturday morning down here in the broadcast bunker, drinking my coffee. And, you know, I've been chilling because it's Thanksgiving weekend, but we are getting ready for a work week next week. And I'm going to be taking a break probably early next week. So for the last 4 days of November, I'm just going to chill for a little while. So this will be the last podcast for a couple of days, probably until the next Bob Davis Podcast radio show. So this one, just FYI, this podcast is, you know, I don't want to talk about what's going on politically, not because I have some kind of aversion to it, because I kind of do. But I wanted to just reset with what some of the things that I think need to get done are. So this podcast is a little dense in the sense that it's pretty political. So, but it's not political like reactive political. You know, we don't talk enough about issues, and this one ends up kind of focusing on economics. So, you know, I'll probably do another foreign policy one, but I wanted to just you know, put together four sort of mini podcasts for the week, starting off with some of the issue stuff rather than so much of the reactive news and the personality oriented political news. So let's just get into segment one of this week's Bob Davis Podcast radio show. Here we go. Welcome to the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show. For all the Bob Davis podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcast.com. Well, yeah, this has been a great Thanksgiving weekend. Hope you had a good time. I hope you didn't get too crazy. And it is back to work this week, and it's a big run from here to Christmas. I did a Thanksgiving podcast, and I talked about how we kind of force a whole bunch of living from Thanksgiving to Christmas to New Year's, and it gets a little stressful. And I don't want to devote too much time to it, but this is a high-pressure time for most people. It shouldn't be, but it is. And for political people especially, in addition to all of that you know, familial holiday pressure, when you add all of that to media coverage of politics, it can be a little bit much. So in this show, I want to pull back up to about 25,000 feet for a wider world view and a wider political view to talk a little bit about what we have ahead. And it's way up. It's, you know, it's not related to anything in particular, although I will mention the election here and there. But this isn't about what has happened in the last few days. It isn't about what happened last week. It isn't about all of this reactive coverage, because the reactive coverage is not proactive. There is no coverage of issues still. They are still waiting for something to happen, then they react or they predict. And basically, the news is just retweets. Somebody tweets something, and we have 4 days of coverage about the reaction to the tweet. No issue coverage. Really, yeah, we still have reports on stories that are actually happening. But most of what you see, again, is a reaction to something someone did, said, or intends to do, or it's prediction of the future based on what someone said or intends to do. And I think it's a good idea to pull away from that and consider some basic ideas about what you might think, what I think we actually need when it comes to something that we call government. Perhaps some benchmarks to measure performance against in the next couple of years, because I think the next couple of years can be pivotal in terms of the political spectrum. Again, I did not endorse, support, or campaign for any of the major candidates or political parties. I don't intend to. I don't have to defend what they do, and I won't. I will give credit where credit is due, but Republicans are in the best position politically the party has been in for some time. That is, they have election certificates giving them control of a majority of state houses, many, if not the majority, it's many governorships, Congress, and the Senate, and now the presidency. And eventually, depending on who is appointed to the Supreme Court, they will have at least more input on the court. They've done this not through so-called conservative politicking. That would take a seven-hour show to explain because it's so complex. Most of the congressmen, senators, governors, and state legislators elected are, in fact, moderate, quote-unquote, establishment Republicans. So when we think about what they'll do, that's kind of where we are coming from. What marked this election was the rhetoric used by the presidential candidate, which cloaked politics that really goes against the grain of what Republican politics has been in this country since the Reagan era. Examples. Well, you know, they're talking about $1 trillion stimulus in the works, which is what Obama did that produced so much negative reaction in terms of spending, if you'll recall, and it really didn't work in developing the economy. Discussions now about keeping major parts of the Affordable Care Act, including the state exchanges, which is a big surprise. Backpedaling on building the big, beautiful wall, ending up with a sort of mid-80s style immigration reform bill and no mass deportations, which was promised. This was the immigration rhetoric that Trump ran on. Suddenly, the Republicans in the House wonder whether they will be able to resuscitate the coal industry in West Virginia after the presidential candidate promised these people would be, quote unquote, back. Discussions on keeping the Iran treaty deal after castigating Clinton for and the current administration for it. And then also discussions on keeping or amending in some way, shape or form the TPP trade deal with qualifications. So suddenly now there's some major backpedaling on policy. And then when we get to the foreign policy front, which I'm probably not going to have time to talk too much about in this show, we're hearing murmurs suddenly about North Korea. Russia is moving medium-range missile systems closer into the Balkans and Eastern Europe in response to what they say is unnecessary expansion of NATO. And of course, the Russia, Syria, and ISIS problems remain in the Middle East, and we have troops still in Afghanistan. So there's a lot of challenges for the Republicans in terms of figuring out how they're going to deal with all this. And again, I'm hearing a lot of discussion about what was said about these issues, not much of the dynamics of the actual implementation of plans and how it will affect the outcome or what the actual issue is. And certainly, there is very little discussion from a higher attitude or a higher altitude about what we actually need to go forward into the future. And really, most of that discussion is still in academic and government circles, and it doesn't get covered. So unless you listen to the Brookings podcast or the or read AEI or, you know, are actually at a university teaching history or something, you don't hear too much conversation about this stuff. Because why? Well, we're too busy talking about Trump's tweets about the Hamilton cast or Kanye West's latest nervous breakdown or a bunch of idiots shouting Hail Trump, at some kind of gathering that has convinced people on the left that there is now something to fear from the fascist on the right, right? And those are all quotes. That's all scare quotes in there. We're not getting deeper into these issues or what specifically we need to address challenges and opportunities for the future. So rather than talk more about the media and how it covers things, which I do all the time and I'm getting tired of it, what it considers news, you know, I've hosed that down ad infinitum, and I'm just not going to do that anymore, at least for a while or until they do something stupid. I want to talk about the greater challenges and opportunities that we need to address in the future. The Republicans probably aren't going to address these challenges and opportunities, and of course the Democratic Party won't, and the people won't address it until our understanding of the political process matures beyond tweets and Facebook posts to some kind of organization, which is one of the things I've been out talking about and pushing all along. And, you know, there are so many complex things that we have to talk about, whether it's the economy or foreign policy or social policy, demography. I have said, and I've said it repeatedly, and I'll continue to say it, that I think that we are seeing a realignment of the two-party political system. Had dinner with some friends last night, and there's still this belief, and it isn't even a partisan belief, but there is still this belief that somehow we can have a system where several small parties are represented in the Senate and the House and in state governments. And that would be a parliamentary system, which the United States does not have. People do not understand the actual structure of the United States government and the state governments in the way that they function and how they work. And so they have this disdain for two parties. They don't understand that that, we have had several different parties become the Republican and Democrat Party over the last 200 and some years. And these two parties will not be permanent. They will change in the future. And so, you know, we're in the midst of a demographic change. We're in the midst of a social change. We're in the midst of a world change. We're in the midst of a technology revolution that really is probably going to end up being bigger than the Industrial Revolution. You know, there's so many pieces coming together at this particular point in time. You know, this doesn't mean that it's all going to change in one day. It just means that we're on the cusp of this change, and this is what is roiling everything and causing a lot of issues. So we don't talk about that stuff because we're too busy focusing on these day-to-day things that supposedly have great impact. But then when you go back and look at them, you don't. Nobody's going to remember Kanye West's nervous breakdown in 10 years. You know, nobody's going to remember the Hamilton cast in 10 years. Nobody's going to remember this stuff because it's not important. What's important is where we're going, how we're going to get there, what kind of government we're going to have, what we need for economic growth, and on and on and on. So we're going to talk about that in this show. And first, we're going to talk about the economy. Then I'm going to talk about the mission of the government. And then I'll sum it up with a discussion of demographics and our place in history at this time next. So coming up, what do we need to grow the U.S. economy dynamically? This is the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show. Well, back in the studio, live. We're definitely laundering now. And just ahead of segment two of the Bob Davis Podcast radio show for this week, I think it is number 54, if it matters. I just want to talk real quick about emergency service and cold weather. So, you know, we're getting there. We had a little snow this weekend, and now we're, as we head to Christmas, you know the deep freeze is coming. Greg Ryan likes to call this climate change. And that is the climate change that we're all familiar with here in Minneapolis and St. Paul. So all fall, I've been saying, have them come out and check your heating and so forth. We're going to shift because it's going to start getting cold, and you're going to start hearing people talking about, hey, I need a plumber. You know, somebody put something on Facebook the other day. One of my friends was like, oh, my God, we had pipes burst. We need a plumber. When you want reliable service, that means Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul. You call 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. They go back four generations in St. Paul. What do they do? Quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems. They do residential, and they do a lot of business. And, you know, business gets the short shrift when it comes to discussing emergency service because, you know, businesses, of course, need it as well. So remember, just like a sticker on your water heater, think Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul, 651-224-4771. In Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. Online at ryanplumbing.com. Now, when they come out to do your emergency service, if you still want to do heating checks, they're still available. They go metro-wide from St. Paul, so they can get a plumber to you, whether you're, you know, in South St. Paul or Plymouth or St. Louis Park or someplace like that. So it doesn't matter whether you are in the Minneapolis and St. Paul metro, they can get you. Also, check them out online at ryanplumbing.com. Lots of content there, and it'll help you find them if you need them. So, again, emergency service, very important in the winter. I've had pipes burst in the winter. Things go wrong in the winter. It's always at the worst possible time, usually right before Christmas or right before New Year's. Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul, 651-224-4771. In Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. And good luck this winter, and thanks to Greg Ryan and Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcast. All right, let's get to segment two of this week's Bob Davis Podcast radio show. You're hearing the Bob Davis Podcast radio show. For more of the Bob Davis Podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcast.com. This is the Bob Davis Podcast radio show. So we keep hearing the U.S. economy is fixed, and usually we hear that in the context of what it was like in 2008 and how much work had to be done to quote-unquote fix it. But the reality is we have not seen over 3% growth in any of those years in the last 8 years. Most quarters are an anemic 1.5 or no growth GDP with some spikes here and there in terms of economic growth. When we start talking about unemployment, again, here's another thing. Well, it's 4.9% or it's 4.6%. We should all be happy. But people don't understand how the Bureau of Labor Statistics itself says that these basic concepts about unemployment are calculated. So here's what they say are the basic concepts about calculating unemployment in the United States. This is the government's own language. People with jobs are employed. People who are jobless looking for a job and available for work are unemployed. The labor force is made up of the employed and the unemployed. People who are neither employed nor unemployed are not in the labor force. The other thing is they don't do a survey of all the people that are on assistance. Unemployment is calculated by not counting all the people receiving unemployment benefits, but they conduct a survey of something like 60,000 homes, and they add new sample to that every month, but it's basically a rolling average talking to those same homes every month. Statistically, I suppose you could say that that's fine, but the government has also tweaked what they consider employed, as many of you know, over the years, particularly the last 8 years. Part-time jobs, for example, now are counted as employment. Long-term unemployment does not figure in the unemployment statistic that is covered in the media, and we know that we have a serious problem with long-term unemployment. So the official unemployment rate is 4.9% as of October of 2016, but the U6, or total unemployed plus all persons marginally attached to the labor force plus total employed part-time for economic reasons as a percent of the civilian labor force plus all persons marginally attached to the labor force is 9.5%. Unemployment among the civilian labor force is 5.2%. Now, this doesn't mean that we have a depression with people standing in soup lines. I didn't see soup lines when I traveled most of the country this year, but it means that things are not as rosy as the government would have us believe, and defenders of the president would have us believe. And when you combine the real unemployment numbers with the GDP numbers, well, you can see why people are so concerned about the economy. I think this is the number one issue. It just seeps out in different ways, in different language. Now, we're doing better than we were doing during the contraction and banking crisis of 2008, but we really have not recovered from that. We have not recovered fast or high enough to make up for the ground that we lost in 2008. This is why it feels like we are living in the matrix. And again, I think this is the issue. This is at the heart of almost all that ails us, whether we are, it's why we're at each other's throats. It's why we are suspicious and angry of the government. It's why we are frustrated with the rest of the world, because things aren't working right. We're not getting any further down the road. And this is especially true for people starting businesses, trying to maintain or build small businesses, or for small businesses that are trying to become medium or large businesses, and for people who are getting older in the workforce, even if they don't realize that they're getting older in the workforce. Because big businesses have the same kinds of pressures that all of us small business people do, and that is we've got to control our costs. And big businesses control their costs by controlling their workforces. And the easiest thing to do is to get rid of the older people who are making more and bring in the younger people who will do things for less. They consistently, in big companies, trim older, more expensive workers, senior workers, let's say, not even necessarily that old, for newer or younger workers who will work for less and longer hours. So higher productivity without necessarily productivity improvements. That is most of the friction, I think, when it comes to economy in the United States, not growing fast enough. And what ends up happening is everybody in business is struggling to make money in a slow economy. If possible, businesses take on debt to grow their market share, cutting into profits, forcing layoffs and reduction in labor costs. When you hear these profit numbers, or when you hear Warren Buffett is worth so many billions of dollars, what you're not looking at is how much debt those companies have also taken on. And in most cases, a company's net worth, their value cap, whatever you want to call it, their market cap, has to be considered in relation to the amount of debt that they also have. The other thing that's happening is people are pushed out of the labor force into starting their own businesses, or they're just plain out. And so they are struggling. Again, why? Because we are not growing fast enough. Meanwhile, The technology really has never been better. You can do more with less. I know because I am doing more with less. You can do a lot as one person. If you can figure out a point of difference or provide a unique or even a not unique service, if you could just find a better way to communicate your not unique service, you can do well. You can market online. In fact, you have to market online, digital marketing, but you can also sell online, communicate with customers in real time online and so forth. So the tools of business have changed drastically and you can do a lot more with fewer people. But that process is not happening fast enough, and we're not making enough money. So what do I think we need? Well, I think we need an approach to government and the economy that encourages dynamic growth. And that means we have to have above 4% growth consistently. And you heard that rhetoric on the campaign trail. The whole policy debate should be, how do we make that happen? And this is where we get into troubles, because government stimulus, government spending is a part of the GDP. If you spend money, you're going to increase the GDP. But the question is that going to make any difference? Where does the government get the money to spend to stimulate the economy? Well, it can sell bonds, which is essentially stock in America. It can tax, or it can borrow the money, which is also bond sales, which they have to pay back. So sooner or later, you end up in a situation where you are taking money from the deep end of the pool and pouring it into the shallow end in an effort to make the shallow end deeper. It doesn't work. I believe the force of nature known as the U.S. economy is hampered by the following very quickly: too much regulation, too much debt, too much spending. And just very quickly, federal and state and local spending will be $6.89 trillion, with federal spending at $4.15 trillion, state at $1.63 trillion, and local at $1.81 trillion. We have $19 trillion in debt. We have about a $16 trillion economy. And we have too much government, whether it's local regulatory boards, state governments, federal government, the costs to administer, as well as the legislative output of these bodies, which is the regulation. Some people say that the cost of regulation is somewhere around $15,000 per household. And this affects productivity. You know, it affects productivity, and productivity and the increase of productivity is the single most important thing that you can do to grow the economy. So getting real growth takes advantage of technology. It means a change in our philosophy about what government's role is in our lives and how it works, and a change in our approach to how we influence our government. So we're going to talk about that in the next segment. Coming up, what is our philosophy of government? How did we get here? And how do we get out? This is the Bob Davis Podcasts Radio Show. Alabama. Yeah, one of the things that's cool about the radio show is it's literally four mini podcasts. So if you're, driving to work or whatever, commuting, somebody posted, it was Sean, and I really appreciated this on Twitter. You know, Bob Davis is one of my companions for the commute, and he lives way up in the North Metro and here in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And he listed a couple of others, Dr. Drew's podcast, which I thought was really cool. It's nice to be in good company. But the cool thing about this podcast, particularly the radio show podcast, is it's four mini segments. So you can stop it and restart it and listen to it later and different things. It's not 35 or 40 minutes straight through. You have four sort of mini podcasts. And that's kind of the way I've been promoting it, just because I think that's kind of fun. And, after we have a little break, we're going to be getting back to the shorter, commute style podcast, because, I do think it helps focus the content a little bit. This is a little more difficult. Getting all this content into four small segments for radio is difficult. It's one of the reasons radio is more difficult, because you really have to focus what you say. Sometimes it doesn't work very well, but these are themes that I'll revisit as we go forward, but I thought I would mention that. So this was a great week for me. I'm back at yoga, and of course, I'm running, to the break. So we had a Thanksgiving break, but I go every day, but you really should take a break once a week. So just this last week, I practiced. I think I did 9 or 10 days straight because I wanted to, I couldn't get to yoga classes on Thanksgiving because they ended too early in the day, because, you know, noon or two is too early for me. But I really pounded the Hydras this week, and I always talk about Hydras because this has really transformed my yoga practice, and I've often said it, and it's true. I don't, you know, soreness and maybe a little bit of pain has never bothered me because it's just you go back the next day, and I just ignored it because I felt that soreness and pain just went with the territory with doing a lot of yoga every day. And then I found Hydras. Hydras is a new high-performance beverage that uses exclusive NanoSom technology to deliver critical electrolytes with unrivaled speed and effectiveness with no sugar that you find in traditional sports drinks. What does that mean? It means there's no sugar, obviously, but it means that it's basically the material in your cells. So what happens is when you use Hydras, you dilute it into 16.7 ounces of water, maybe a capful of Hydras. You drink it before, after, and during exercise. You get electrolytes into your muscles really, really fast. And I was skeptical, and then I started using it, and I mean, I'm telling you, it has allowed me to get down to the grit, is what I call it. There's other terms. Wrestlers have other terms for it, too, but you can work deeper. I guess that's the best way to explain it, and it will transform and improve whatever practice you have, whether it's CrossFit or cycling or competitive sports or lifting, or maybe you just go hunting, or maybe you walk or whatever. It's pretty amazing. Older people have been drinking it. It makes a huge difference, even in their lives, because we are usually pretty dehydrated in the West because we drink a lot of sugary drinks. We drink a lot of Diet Coke and things of that nature. Even if you just drink water, you won't get hydrated fast enough if you're taking exercise at a pretty intense pace. So here's what you do. Get yourself some Hydras. You'll be amazed. It helps me take it to the edge. And of course, that is what it's all about. Join the performance hydration revolution. I'm proud to have them as sponsors of the Bob Davis podcast. Visit HydrasPerformance.com. That's HYDRUS, HydrasPerformance.com, HydrasPerformance.com. Get some and then correspond with me, you know, on Twitter or Facebook or email or whatever, and let me know what your experience has been, because I love hearing stories about Hydras. All right, let's get back to it. This is segment 3 of this week's Bob Davis podcast radio show. Here we go. You're listening to the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show. To hear all the podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcast.com. Welcome back. So I started this show asserting that the political discussion that we're having in this country is not helping. And the discussion we have had is not helping. It's never approached discussing the issues. You know, it never really has gotten into why people are upset, and it is really unfortunate because we haven't discussed all the parts of the political spectrum active at this time in our history. We've just been talking about reactions to things without getting into the root causes or the root discussion about issues. Now, I listed the economy and foreign policy and our philosophy as government as stuff I wanted to talk about in this show. The fact is that those issues are so large and complex, we can only really deal with a few concepts in a short radio show. I really do believe most of our problems are related to economy. The questions that stem from any attempt to fix or change our approach to the economy and end up touching on everything else, especially when you get into the effects. Before we talk about trade issues, before we deal with other countries, or before we talk about how we defend the country and the people in this country, or rights, or even domestic policy, at the root of it all is the pursuit of happiness, right? It's the pursuit of, you know, your life, making more money and raising your family and doing your things. And talking about the economy brings up issues that touch on our philosophy of government, what we think the government is supposed to do, what we think it should do, what it does. You know, how we think it should be structured are at the root of almost all of these discussions, which are being held on a rhetorical basis. But it's also the discussions we're not having these days, because what are we doing? We're talking about tweets or insults or some silly thing that happened. We think these things have great impact and reflect on who we are as a people and where our politics is headed, but really they don't, because that is what we are told. We're told that they have great impact, but they don't. They become conversational issues and end up distracting from the most important questions during the transitional time that we are now living through, and we think they're great issues because the media tells us that. What do you think the government should do? Do you understand what is required of the government to do the things you want it to do? The costs, the personnel, the body of law and regulation that actually empowers the government to do what you want it to do and what you don't want it to do. Lots of people have lots of ideas about what the government is supposed to do. I do. You do. This is why state and federal governments, but the local governments too, have become the most expensive, overbearing, inefficient, and pernicious forces in our society these days. Most of the time, they are holdovers from the past, ancient relics from ancient times, institutions designed for an agricultural or industrial age, even the ones that were created late in our lifetimes, you know, in the 70s and 80s, the Department of Energy or the Department of Education are really relics from the industrial age. They don't necessarily serve us today, but yet we are paying for them and they have control of many things. We are, in fact, living through the first flush of a technical revolution that is going to end up dwarfing the Industrial Revolution in terms of its impact. Opportunities and challenges created by this force are enormous. Opportunities and challenges government is not just ill-equipped to handle, but absolutely the wrong institution to handle them. What are some of the artifacts of this that are beginning to really develop? Well, project workers who function as consultants, so-called 1099 workers, who work on an ad hoc basis rather than working for specific companies. Untethered workforces and businesses being operated from all over the place without having to be in a specific place. And you're seeing office space prop up or pop up businesses that serve people working from coffee shops and everything else. Autonomous machines and software running, building, and distributing products and services that used to require buildings full of workers don't. You don't need that anymore. Manufacturing and service capabilities all over the world. Vast and complex communication systems that aren't licensed. Information distribution that is more like a virus in spreading than talking to some kind of a captive audience. Huge advances in nutrition and medical science, and a lot of things that I, you know, obviously haven't mentioned that are happening and form a massive crust of technological research and development beneath the surface that is eventually going to change the world. It's going to affect productivity. It's going to affect how you live. It's going to affect who you talk to. And if the economy can grow dynamically, it will change our world significantly faster. I want it to change the world significantly faster. If you could wipe away all the contracts of the past, what kind of government would you create? If you could get rid of the past and start over, how would you ensure and defend personal sovereignty, protect what you have, foster new growth, keep the peace, ensure equal opportunity, and get out of the way so that the economy, us, can grow and contract at its own pace? When you think of it that way, where does invading foreign countries come in? Where does spying on people come in? Where does telling states and localities what they can and can't do without any choice on their part come in? Where do so-called nudge economic policies that say, we will give you a tax break, or if you do this, you get federal funding come in? What is the public good in this kind of an environment? If corporations and small business are using technology to increase productivity, to increase their footprint, so an individual can look like a much bigger company. Bigger companies can be more efficient. Where does a massive government labor force with benefits and pensions and low productivity come in? And why are those of us who are starting businesses or working paying for that? I don't think most of those institutions of government these days, state, federal, and local, have any place in a new world where it might be possible that you would have an automobile plant right down the block, you would have driverless cars, autonomous street cleaning machines and buses, and you know the ability to project your intellectual property throughout the world. Those are things some of that we already have. And as that progresses, we're going to see more and more of that. We should have have access to markets with billions of people in them, and they should have access to ours. The bigger the government, the bigger the tax. The more the government is responsible for, the bigger the tax bill, and the higher the debt, and the more possibility of great danger resulting from bad policy, whether like it or not, actually does kill people and creates problems. That's the pernicious power of government. We don't think about these questions. We only think, well, if you didn't have the government, terrible things would happen. Maybe, but terrible things are happening because of governments, and terrible things have happened in the past because of government. And we have to figure out what the trade-off is, or we're just not going to go forward. Right now, we are pitted against each other. We look at things from one perspective and one perspective only. It's our little place in the world where we are pinned based on what we think is important news or how we react to various kinds of stimuli. And the people in charge know that. You know, they have people that can tell them what to do and how to say and how to do things so that they get this kind of reaction. And we as citizens, well, we're just pinned in place because we're reacting to this stuff. And if there's a demographic and sociographic shift going on in this country, then these are the questions we need to ponder. We really need to think about what we're going to do with the government and how it's going to be structured rather than whether or not someone is a fascist. With current economic growth worldwide, debt spending and debt levels and spending levels, the current governments are just not going to survive. We have to cut spending in the role of government. And it's either, if we don't, it's either going to fall apart or expand to tyrannical levels. Some think it already has. And it doesn't matter who's president. It doesn't matter which party is in control. They're going to panic and protect the integrity of government, which is probably exactly the wrong thing to do. So Republican or Democrat, it doesn't matter. We need a weaker, smaller government, especially when it comes to the economy. We need weaker state governments. We need good money. We need less regulation. And we need to eliminate large portions of federal and state government spending. And that's a real challenge. So coming up, things are changing in this country fast, especially when it comes to demographics. We're going to talk about that. For more of the Bob Davis Podcast and to sign up for the Bob Davis Podcast newsletter, visit thebobdavispodcasts.com. This is the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show. Back in the studio. You know, I should do, like, I need to get a washing machine sponsor. Because I think it's great to do the radio show while I'm doing chores, like the laundry. But just, you know, one of my little chores that I do is I love, when I'm not traveling, I love to go over to the revetment for Mobile Podcast Command, my Ford 2000 Super Duty 450 ambulance diesel, and fire it up and, you know, just let it run for a little while. I do that usually once a week just to make sure that everything's good. And it, of course, is also plugged into the block heater. But, you know, I don't like leaving it sitting there. I like to take it out and drive it, even if I go around the block or just run it. And, of course, xgovernmentcars.com is the ancestral home of Mobile Podcast Command. And I love ex-government cars. They're Minnesota's only dealer specializing in these one-owner, professionally maintained government fleet cars, trucks, and SUVs. I was parking it at the Monte Carlo last night in downtown Minneapolis. And the guy was like, God, I wanted one of these cars. I remember, you know, I wanted to buy one, and I never got around to it. And I'm telling you, they're great. They still have the Crown Vics. They also have the Ford Police Sedans. They have the Dodge Chargers. They have the Chevy Impala V8s. They have Yukons, Expeditions, SUVs, the Ford Police SUV. If you need a car, you need a loan. If you have a work truck that you need, if you have a job, you're approved. Ex-government cars also takes trades. They pay the highest values every day without all the bull. I've seen them do it. Don't forget, they also have the the 3-day Love It Guarantee exclusively at X Government Cars. So here's what you do. First of all, you can go online at xgovernmentcars.com and check out the inventory. But really get your butt down to xgovernmentcars.com because you got to see them and try them out and drive them. They're awesome. They're now open in Golden Valley at 2420 Nevada Avenue North. It's easy to get to pretty much all over the metro. You can also call them old school, 763-777-8782. They'd love to talk to you. And yes, I have the megaphone. Here we go.
xgovernmentcars.com.
You know, and while we're at it, I should mention the digital sponsor of the Bob Davis podcast, Alpha Systems. And this is for pilots. Here's the whole thing. Your wing is what's providing the lift underneath the airplane. Everybody knows that. If you're a pilot, you don't need to have me tell you that. But the whole point of AOA or angle of attack is knowing how much lift those wings are producing, especially when you turn to the final approach to the runway. This is the most difficult process in general aviation. It's very dangerous. That's why you need a visual indicator of how much lift the wings are producing. And Alpha Systems' motto is pilots fly safe, or helping pilots fly safe. It has saved lives. If you want to find out more, click on the Alpha Systems banners at the top of the Bob Davis podcast page for more info about Alpha Systems. There's a ton of it there on their website. So thanks again to Alpha Systems for being the digital sponsor of the Bob Davis podcast. All right, here is segment 4 for this week's Bob Davis podcast radio show. Number what? 54. All these numbers. Here we go. You're listening to the Bob Davis Podcast radio show. Remember, for all the Bob Davis podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcast.com. Okay, we talked about the economy. We've talked about the future. We've talked about what we face and how we're not talking about these issues, in my view. And without discussion among citizens about what's needed and what kinds of tools that we're going to be able to use in the future and how that's going to affect society and what kind of government society needs, how do you expect anything to change? Right? There are also powerful economic and social forces at work, whether it's world economy and world trade issues, age, gender, race, social strata, and the kinds of issues that social strata and racial issues, racism, gender issues, age issues have, and how people view things depending on their age. Now, that's probably been slightly overemphasized. The baby boom population, those people, 75 million or so Americans born between 1946 and 1960, have reached their maturity. Most of them are really, surprisingly enough, senior citizens, at once a protected class and a less politically robust and powerful class because they don't have the energy of youth, right? So it's age and treachery overcomes youthful exuberance. Baby boomers are unique because during that period of time from 1946 to 1960, year-to-year births were well over the 4.5 million mark. And so the so-called pig in a python generation, that's what the baby boom looks like on a demographic chart, is different in that respect because it happened and it was a very large group within a very short period of time. And they are different from the younger brothers and sisters and children and grandchildren. Academics now simply break generations into 20-year spans because it's easy, but that doesn't mean that there's a generational identity that you could call Gen X, Millennials, Gen Y, Gen Z. Media attention to these groups place characteristics on them, which I think may or may not be true. So some demographers think the whole idea of the millennial generation is nonsense, which brings into question, what is Gen Y and what is Gen X? And I get that question all the time. Without the existence of the baby boom generation, a generation is being materially different in values from a previous generation. Without the baby boom, which was materially different in values from their World War II era parents, we really probably wouldn't look at younger generations of Americans in the same way. In fact, generation gap or generation or even baby boom or even naming generations, even the concept of childhood and adolescence are relatively new in social history related to the Industrial Revolution and leisure time, not necessarily related to demographic changes in the United States. One thing is true. The up-and-coming young adults and middle-aged adults these days look at things differently from their older brothers and sisters, parents, and grandparents. They are more accepting of and more prolific users of technology, especially Gen Y and Z. It's very funny to hear baby boomers who used to be so adamant about the younger generation decrying these kids and their cell phones and talking about how lazy they are and they don't want to work and everything else. They have different attitudes about religion, and they have different attitudes about ethnicity and sexuality and how we treat each other. And they're materially different attitudes than their older brothers and sisters, parents, and grandparents. And again, it's amusing to see people attach values to younger people that never include their children. This is a generation that talked about freedom and free love, supposedly bemoaning their children's attitudes that are basically continuations of the same concepts, which are personal liberty most of the time. Anyway, I digress. They are also a little bit more international. They think of the world more as a community than a bilateral frontier. Younger generations get their news from social media and online sources. Most of them are very concerned about their financial future, surprisingly conservative here, and higher education levels. They have higher education levels than their parents. And my understanding is that they have tended to marry a little bit earlier. You know, and by the way, here again, baby boom parents should know because they put their kids through college and insisted that they got a college education. So they're also more ethnically diverse, especially in places like California and urban areas. But here again, ethnic and gender groups do not always vote as a bloc. So-called Hispanics do not vote as a bloc. Women do not vote as a bloc. So the idea that we can look at a generation of tens of millions of people, young or old, and say this is what they think is deeply flawed, I think. Only a small generation of the workforce in the United States works in construction, mining, or manufacturing. This is another thing people need to understand. You hear all the time about workers, but we're not talking about construction workers and manufacturing people and people in mining. The fact is 81 to 90% of the workforce in this country is basically white collar. They are employed in the service sector, and they will be increasingly employed in the service sector where there is huge value added. Only about 1.5% of the workers in this country are employed in the agricultural sector, which used to be the biggest sector of employment in this country. And this is not going to change, especially when you consider all of the technology that can be used, 3D printing to build houses, autonomous machines, other kinds of tech being used in all these areas where it doesn't take the number of workers that it used to take to produce the same result. Most people will be in offices and some kind of working with computers because, you know, autonomous machines are going to be doing a lot of the manufacturing work, and our outputs will be higher than ever. They just won't employ the same number of people. These are the primary reasons the political spectrum, the basis of the current two-party system in the United States, is beginning to decay, to change, to reset, to evolve, whatever you want to say. But what it evolves into is another question. Saying it is this or that right now is probably premature. I think the current election is not so much historic as a harbinger of change. I think it's the beginning of a major shift. Neither candidate was very appealing. The truth is most of the people did not participate. I'm not going to say most of the people. Voter participation was very low. So our task is first to begin educating ourselves because the media is not going to do it. We can't do it by passively looking at websites. Developing a political concept that addresses our needs is the next step, or at least the needs we can assess for the long-term future. Then we have to develop a political catechism that can be spread and taught. And finally, we have to create a political movement that does the following: permanent reduction in the ability of the government to enlarge itself as the result of taxation, permanent reduction in the power of the government over the individual, permanent elimination of the government's power to control money, reinforcement of the basic sovereign rights of the citizens, not how we're treated, but the recognition of our sovereignty. And that's my short list. The key word here is permanent. The goal is a looser, much less powerful, smaller cheaper government at all levels with many, many fewer employees. And that is going to ask a lot of us as citizens, because it isn't going to happen in one election. It won't happen with the existing political parties. It's going to take political organization to put pressure on the existing politicians and force them into this new camp with the intent of literally dismantling this massive federal, state, and local government structure that we have. This election did not result in that. Either candidate would or will increase the power of government. Either party will or would increase the power of government at different speeds depending on their approach to government. That doesn't make one better than the other. It makes them the same. Eventually, the power of the government, as I said in the last segment, is going to become permanent. And eventually, they do become permanent. Entitlements become permanent, and so does the power to administer those entitlements. Many people throughout the political spectrum, especially some who call themselves quote-unquote conservatives, simply do not understand that. It is not an argument for freedom and the Constitution. It is an argument for what we must have if we are to solve economic problems we face and take advantage of the opportunities. If we don't, some other country will, and we will fade from history. It won't be the first time, and many people think it is already happening. Maybe this election is the best evidence that it is happening. Now, it doesn't have to be this way, but more is going to be required from people than reacting to something someone said or did or the way someone looks or someone's personality. We're going to have to learn how to organize. We're going to have to learn how to remain organized and keep people enthused. We're going to have a movement that actually accomplishes something. And if we don't, well, okay, that's fine. I'm not necessarily attached to that, but we do have to understand as politically involved people that it's going to require much more of us as human beings and citizens. And we're going to have to change a lot about how we talk about politics, how we work in politics, and how we view the people that we're working with. And we'll talk more about this in future shows. But this is 25,000 miles up, and I'm not going to keep talking about the same old stuff. All right? Thanks for listening. But it's going to do it for this Bob Davis Podcast radio show for this week. Of course, for all the podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcast.com. This is the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show. Always nice to throw a little bit of the soundtrack of Bullet in there. I love that movie. It's my favorite movie of all time, pretty much. I don't know why, because it's great. It's all right. It's a good movie. It's not the greatest movie ever, but it's pretty close to certainly the greatest filmed car chase in history. I don't think anything compares with the car chase in Bullet. All right. Appreciate all the sponsors of the Bob Davis Podcast. Hydrus. Don't forget HydrusPerformance.com, HYDRUS. It will transform whatever physical practice you're doing. Ryan Plumbing and Heating of St. Paul, especially for you people looking for emergency service in St. Paul, 651-224-4771. In Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. Online at RyanPlumbing.com. And of course, the granddaddy of Bob Davis Podcast sponsors, XGovernmentCars.com in Golden Valley at 2420 Nevada Avenue North. XGovernmentCars.com is the only dealer in Minnesota specializing in one owner, professionally maintained government fleet cars, trucks. Now, see, the laundry's ready to go in the dryer and SUVs. X-Government Cars, I love them, and I've had 3 Crown Vics and now, of course, Mobile Podcast Command. And again, thank you for listening to the Bob Davis Podcasts on Stitcher.com. I think we fixed the link at TuneIn. I don't know why it keeps blowing up. iTunes, blogtalkradio.com, gcnlive.com. Thanks for listening, sharing, and favoriting, and following on Facebook and Twitter. I love Instagram. And thanks for your donations for Mobile Podcast Command. Fuel for the next big trip out. I have some ideas. I'm not saying what they are, but I'll tell you when we get later in the year in 2017. So stand by for that. And thanks for your donations just in general for the fuel for Mobile Podcast Command at thebobdavispodcast.com. Just look for the donate button. Plus, we put a banner up with a picture of the truck in, of all places, White Sands, New Mexico. That is not snow. So click on that banner at the top of the Bob Davis podcast page. All right. Without any further ado, I think it's time to get the laundry out and put it into the dryer, hopefully. Thanks for listening to podcast 576, the Bob Davis podcast, the Bob Davis podcast radio show for this week.